Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Okay. Folks, welcome to the Sydney Institute, again here at the Gallipoli Club in Sydney. It's a great location, and Professor Joan Beaumont makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. She's been here on a couple of occasions before. I will introduce our speaker. Joan Beaumont is an internationally recognised historian of Australia in the two world wars, the history of prisoners of war, and the memory and the heritage of war. She is Professor of History at the Strategic and Defence Studies Centre at the Australian National University in Canberra, and has published several books about World War I and World War II. And Professor Beaumont is here tonight, soon after the publication of her most recent book, Broken Nation, Australians in the Great War, which is a fine book of scholarship, as we'll hear shortly, as Professor Beaumont addresses the Sydney Institute on the topic, 1914, a century later. Professor Beaumont, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Gerard. It's a great pleasure to be here this evening. I have taken the liberty of slightly adjusting the title of my address. There is just really so much you could talk about in relation to 1914, which of course I think is coded for the war that was supposed to be the one that ended war, but as we know, tragically did not. So I'll really be talking in some ways about some of the major themes that I tried to engage with when I was writing Broken Nation. As you're all no doubt aware, if you still visit bookstores rather than shop online or download Kindle, the centenary of World War I is swelling the already voluminous literature on Australia and other military histories. And this literature has been growing in volume and to mountainous proportions, really, in the last two decades. So why did I decide to write Broken Nation? Well, quite simply because, remarkably, for all the books about Australian military history, there was no single comprehensive history of Australians at war. That is, a history which attempted to integrate the battles, the home front, Australian diplomacy during the war, and the way in which we remember the war. Most of those many books that you'll find in bookstores were about, and remain about, the history of battles and military units, which is not surprising. Battle, after all, is the essence of war, and the Anzac legend, which is perhaps the most enduring legacy of World War I in Australia, is a story about soldiers and their behaviour and characteristics in battle. But it's always been my belief that World War I is about much more than fighting and killing. You probably know that it was sometimes referred to as the first total war, and it was a conflict in which, for the first time really, civilians were a very important element. What we also tend to forget is that in the case of Australia, being a civilian and staying at home was the experience of the majority of the population. Certainly a remarkable number of Australians enlisted and served overseas. About 417,000 volunteered, not all of them were deemed to be medically fit, and around 330,000 Australians from a population which in 1911 was 4.3 million ultimately served overseas. But for all that, and that's what we often focus on in our remembrance, let's remember that most Australians stayed at home. That's not just women, but even among men of the age bracket, say 18 to 60, some 62% of those men were actually at home. So really then, if we're talking about Australia's experience of World War I, we have to look at much more than the AIF or the Australian Imperial Forces experience. And I believe that's the case because it was the Australian population on the home front, which incidentally was a term that was coined during World War I in recognition of the importance of what was happening at home. It's they who underpinned the national war effort. Of course they didn't fight, but they accepted casualties on a scale which would be unthinkable today. I made the bold statement at the start of my book that no democracy, no modern democracy could fight World War I. I believe that we do not have the tolerance of those casualties that they experienced in those years. But even though the majority of the population did not fight, they did accept those casualties and they mobilised the most enormous amount of resources, their labour, their money, their emotional energy, generally in support of the war. There was very serious economic dislocation at home and a reduced standard of living. And most critically, and I think we tend to forget this, the majority of Australians continued to support World War I for all its terrible cost and believed that the cause for which Australian men were fighting was just. And let me remind you that some domestic populations of World War I ultimately did lose the will to fight, the most famous case, of course, being Russia, which erupted in revolution in 1917, and to some degree Germany also lost the will to fight in late 1918. But although Australians, as I imagine you know, were profoundly divided on the question particularly of conscription, but more widely the issue of how the burden of war should be shared equitably, they never really, as a community, lost the will to continue the war. I need to stress, of course, that consensus was not universal. From the start of the war, the very strong industrial labour movement, there were over 500,000 men in the trade union movement at that time, believed that there was another war going on as well as the one on the Western Front and in the Middle East. And that was a war between capital and labour. One of the most popular figures in cartoons of the period was the bloated plutocrat, who was thought to be making profit at the expense of the war effort and particularly of the working classes, and the word profiteering was coined at this time. So on the right you have the muscular Australian male and the fat plutocrat struggling for supremacy within the world. So this is another war that is going on within Australia that we hear less about now. And ultimately the labour movement started to demand very forcibly an end to the war through a negotiated peace. But for all that, there was no general collapse of morale within Australia on the home front during the war. There was a lot of violence in Australian political life, which again I think we tend to overlook. And certainly the working classes of Australia were deeply radicalised, I would argue, by the experience of war. But Australians did not in the end choose revolution. So I think it's time to see the home front as an essential part of the Australian experience of war. I like to imagine it as being in dialogue with the battlefront. It's often argued that the civilians and the soldiers lived in separate spheres, with the civilians really not understanding what the soldiers were experiencing. And yes, in many ways, the civilians were in a separate sphere. Physically, of course, Australians were very remote from the conflict in Europe or even in the Middle East. They didn't experience occupation or bombing, starvation or homelessness, as some of the refugees in Europe did. Nor, as civilians, could they, I think, ever really begin to imagine the horrors of battle in modern industrial warfare. The terrible noise of artillery, which nearly drove men mad. The fear of being obliterated instantly and arbitrarily. The terrible, obscene injuries inflicted on flesh by shrapnel, machine guns, flamethrowers, bayonets and gas. And, of course, the misery of life in the trenches in winter. And the foulness of gangrene in wounds and trench foot. I'm sure you're all familiar with that kind of image on the left. That's Pozières in the middle of 1916, where the Australians first fought in the Great Battle of the Somme. But on the right is a less known image, which is the winter of 1916-17 on the Somme, which, in the opinion of C.E.W. Bean, our official historian, was probably the most terrible experience, really, on the Western Front, the appalling conditions during the winter, and when many men actually got trench foot and gangrene in their feet. But even though the civilians were clearly quarantined in some way from the war, I would argue they were not emotionally quarantined. The men who went to fight in the war did write home, often very graphically, about wounds, about death, even to my surprise, about the incompetence of the men who were commanding them at times. We often think that all the letters were censored, but when I was doing my research, I was really struck by what still remained in these letters home from the front. To give you one example, there is a family called the Raws family. This was the church I was brought up in Flinders Street, Adelaide. And there was a room at the back of the church called the Raws Room, which I just thought was the Raws Room. I now realise that it was named by the pastor of this church after his two sons, Goldie and Alec Raws, who both died within weeks of each other at Crozier. When Alec Raws volunteered on the 12th of July 1915, you'll see that he spoke very clearly that he was not a great man for heroics, but he did believe that there were some things that were greater, that there were principles for which he needed to fight. He cursed the government systems that were causing the war, and he was very fearful of blood and suffering. But he said at the conclusion, you'll see there are principles, and there are women, and there are standards of decency that are worth... old age. Shedding one's blood for, surely. Death does not matter. Now, I quote that because a year later, Goldie, his brother, was killed, and Alec wrote home to his family. Goldie's death has proved a far greater shock to me than I thought possible since we came out of the line, probably due to nerves. I want to tell you, so that it may be on record, that I honestly believe that Goldie and many other officers were murdered through the incompetence, callousness, and personal vanity of those high in authority. I realise the seriousness of what I say, but I am so bitter, and the facts are so palpable that it must be said. Now, his family received that letter, and even more strikingly, received it after he died. So you can only wonder, you know, what was going on beneath the surface of loyalty and the public rhetoric of stoicism and acceptance in the minds of parents and others who lost their family members in the war. By far the majority of the AIF were unmarried, so the grief was largely that of parents, but there were, of course, wives and others as well. Now, not all soldiers were as outspoken as Alec Raws. Many tried to reassure their families, but the enormous casualty list made it quite clear what a terrible conflict this was. And catastrophe was being inflicted on numerous families and communities. Moreover, the wounded started coming home in mid-1915, together with some cases of venereal disease, who were sort of quietly shepherded away. The wounded were taken through the streets in triumph. The wounded, you see on the left in the boats at Gallipoli, there was very little provision made for them in advance in Gallipoli, and they really did suffer terrible traumas, and probably many of them died who would otherwise have been saved had medical treatment been more speedily administered. On the right, you have some of the long-term wounded after World War I. In many of these homes, it had to be established because they could no longer return to normal life. But the wounded were a very important part of the home front scene, and they were badly wounded. It's been estimated that something like over 80% of men in the British Army who were wounded actually were sent back to the front once they'd been patched up. So to come home, I would argue, you have to have been either an amputee or very severely wounded. And it was sometimes, of course, before shell shock and mental illness was recognised as a cause for repatriation. So I think every dimension of life in Australia was affected by the knowledge of what was happening in France, Belgium, the Middle East. And nowhere is this clearer than in the ebb and flow of recruitment. I'm sure you're all aware that the Australian Army in World War I was entirely an army of volunteers. This is a slide that I prepared for my book, and the darker line is the pattern of recruitment, voluntary enlistment during the war, and the lighter line is the battle casualties. And you'll see that by the end of the war, they're really completely, the number of casualties is massively higher than the number of men replacing them. And this, of course, became a huge issue that triggered the conscription referenda of 1916 and 1917. These conscription debates can only be understood, I believe, against the backdrop of the battles that were occurring at the time. The first, naturally, because of the losses, was held while the Battle of the Somme was being conducted, and the second was being held right at the end of what was probably the worst battle for British armies, Passchendaele, or the Third Ypres. So these families are, you know, receiving huge casualty lists at the very time that they're debating this huge issue about conscription, whether you could force more men to go into what was now recognised to be this huge war, a war that was almost beyond anyone's power to control, and which seemed to have no end in sight, and was just consuming more and more young men. And we cannot understand, I think, the hysteria that occurred in Australia during the conscription debates without acknowledging that. So in some ways, I think what was happening in battles impacted very dramatically on what was happening at home. We don't actually talk much about the reverse flow, if I can call it that. That is how what was happening at home affected the men on the Western Front in particular. I mean, surely the AIF, like all armies of a democracy, looked to the home front to affirm what they were doing. And we know how destructive it can be for armies if it appears that the home front believes the war they're fighting for is pointless or even evil. And the commander of the AIF, General Byrd, would argue that it was actually very important to the men that they felt that the home front was supporting them. This is a remarkable picture of, out in the middle of the Somme winter, the comfort funds, that is the patriotic movements that were generating all these socks and goodies for the men to eat, were offering hot tea in the middle of that winter. And Byrd would maintain that was very important for morale. One also wonders what was the impact of the rejection of conscription on some of the soldiers at the front. It must have conveyed rather ambiguous messages about home front support, even though the vote against conscription was not a vote against the war, as became apparent in the federal election of May 1917. In fact, indeed, many of the AIF themselves opposed conscription. It was only a very narrow vote of the AIF, much to the annoyance of Prime Minister Billy Hughes, who was so confident that the men at the front would vote in favour of conscription that he actually scheduled their vote before the general vote, and then when he discovered that they were likely to vote against, he buried all their votes in the general returns. So the soldiers' votes were actually buried in the electorates from which they came. We never got a total soldier vote, which is very frustrating because we'd love to know exactly how the soldiers did vote. But because conscription was not passed, and you get this gap between enlistments and deaths, you end up with a situation by the end of 1918 when the five divisions that Australia had in the field could no longer be supported. They were really seriously under strength by September, October 1918, perhaps only half of their strength or even lower, and there were no troops to replace them. So in September, October 1918, the authorities had to start reducing the battalions, amalgamating them, and this led to the very few examples of near mutiny on the part of the AIF because they were losing the battalion that they felt so deeply attached to. And I wonder whether, had the war continued into 1919, when it would have been impossible to maintain the five divisions in the field, there might have been not so much an air of triumphalism at the end of the war, but rather decline and perhaps even rebellion. And one wonders if, if it had gone on, perhaps we might have had some potential for a kind of stab in the back theory, the home front didn't support us adequately. That's just counterfactual history. I also think it's important to look at this dialogue between the battlefield and the home front, because it's on the home front, as well as the battlefield, that so much of the damage of the war occurred. Of course, the deaths, the 61,000 plus dead and the 150,000 wounded, occur on the battlefield. But the families had to carry that loss too, and the Australian political system and its social fabric was left deeply injured and maimed by the war. When the war began, there was a quite striking consensus about the need to support Britain, despite that Labour opposition that was on the margins at that point. As you may well be aware, I'm sure, there was a very strong cultural and emotional identification with Britain. Possibly 98%, some estimates, of the Australian population traced its origins to the British Isles. And in addition, it was seen to be absolutely imperative strategically that Australia support the British Empire and the Royal Navy, which was the only way it was believed at the time of guaranteeing Australian security. But by 1916, that consensus was beginning to erode, particularly as the issue of conscription polarised the nation. There were also other issues that were very deeply contentious, such as the rising cost of living, inflation, the declining standard of living of the workers. And they all played together in the terrible conscription referenda campaigns. And the campaigns left Australia, I think, deeply divided along fault lines of, say, the volunteer against the shirker, the conscriptionist against the anti-conscriptionist. And although sectarianism was not created by World War I, of course, the division between Catholics and Protestants, and particularly Irish Catholics and Protestants. The Irish were demonised by Hughes, in no small part because Archbishop Daniel Mannix enjoyed enormously provoking Hughes in the second conscription referendum and provoking Protestants. If you look at the local debates about conscription, people were trading insults and personal abuse in a way that cannot have been forgotten when the war was over. I mean, in fact, public figures were getting up, you know, saying, your son has not gone and yours has. You know, very, very personal disputes within country towns, which no doubt continued to poison public life. This is, you've probably heard, the famous blood vote, which is a classic example of the hysteria that occurred in the conscription campaign. Glasses required. You probably don't have to move away. But just to give you some example, why do you hide your hand, mother, and couch it above in dread? I bear a dreadful brand, my son, with a dead man's blood. Tis red. This is only one example of the kind of emotional content of the conscription campaigns. And, of course, the Labour Party split under the pressures of war. One of my favourite cartoons is the left one from the Australian Worker of Billy Hughes the Rat, you know, who was viewed by the ALP to have absolutely betrayed the Labour movement that he devoted so much of his life to by supporting conscription. You'll notice a little boy from Manly representing Australia on the top, and the trap is the election of 1917. The Worker was confident that the people would ensnare the rat, Billy Hughes. But Hughes was a very clever politician, and of course after being expelled from the Labour Party he joined with the Nationals, the more conservative party, and the one on the right is called the Nuptials, and you'll see Hughes and Joseph Cook being married by, it looks like, the bloated plutocrat again, with the figure of Labour on the left. And this strange cat-like figure is always called the Tory press. Not quite sure why. Someone perhaps can help me with why the Tory press was depicted that way. So Hughes, you know, a bit like Ramsay MacDonald in 1929, the party went but Hughes didn't. And he stayed on, of course, as Prime Minister for several more years and in federal parliament until the Second World War. But Daniel Mannix outlived him. I'm sure that pleased Daniel Mannix greatly. Now, of course, I've talked a lot about the home front, but in the end, one has to concede it's the battles that really matter in any war. Well, they matter very much. And so one of the things I've tried to do in the book is to write about battles in a way that we can all understand. I find military history rather opaque. And I spent a lot of time trying to avoid words like salient and re-entrant. I can tell you there's no other word in the English language for a re-entrant. But I found it very interesting, as I was writing what I hoped was a comprehensive account of the battles of World War I, to see what we don't remember today. We now have a particular hierarchy of battles, of which Gallipoli is clearly number one, possibly Villers-Bretonneux, Pozières, the Somme and Fromelles get widely recognised, but not by my students. Once we get past Gallipoli, they might remember Pozières, but they really don't know much more about the actual contours of the battle in World War I. But this, interestingly, is what appears on the National Memorial of Villers-Bretonneux. They're probably the battles for which the units were given battle honours, but it is very striking, if you can read that, to see names which we'd probably even struggle to put on the map today. So the Australian experience of the Western Front, let alone the Middle East, was very diverse, and I think that complexity has got lost in our memory of the war. That's not surprising, because all history and all memory, if we talk about what nations remember or what they choose to give prominence to in commemoration, is selective. We never remember everything of the past. We make choices about what we remember. And those choices, whether they're at the individual level or the family level or the community or the nation, are clearly shaped by what we think is important today. In that sense, memory and history, that is professional history that tries to tell an accurate account as far as we can of the past, are very different phenomena. Memory is about, I think, as much the values of the present as of the past. And it's quite striking that what we now remember, I think, it's not just Gallipoli, but if we look at what we remember in national commemoration, is a hierarchy of battles or sites of memory that is different from that the Australians remembered in 1919. Now, at the end of World War One, these five divisions, infantry divisions of the Australian Imperial Force, were given the opportunity to choose a location where they would put a memorial in the Western Front to their service. And this is what they chose. I hope you can see this. Alas, this doesn't have a little light on it, or else I would show you. But they chose Pozières for the 1st Division, Mont-Saint-Quentin, down here near Peronne, for the 2nd, a place called Saint-Lysac for the 3rd, a place called Bellinglaise on the Hindenburg Line for the 4th Division, and Polygon Wood for the 5th. I can tell you those wouldn't pass muster with my students, and they certainly don't map easily on today's commemorative priorities. No Fromelle. No thought of putting Fleurbaix, because it would seem that what the men who fought the war wanted to be remembered by was being victorious and not failing. Gallipoli, of course, is the obvious exception, but even that was described as a triumph in the language of Ellis, Ashmead, Bartlett and C.W. Bean. It was a dramatic storming of the cliffs and the hanging on against the odds that was celebrated, not the fact that ultimately the Allies were pushed off the peninsula. And it is striking that today, when we talk about the soldiers who died in World War One, it's very much the language of victims and trauma. Scholars would say that to some degree it reflects the dominance of the Holocaust in modern memory. And in many ways, strange ways, the men who fought the war have almost become depicted as mere victims, non-consenting victims, and so mutineers and rebels become the sort of archetypal figure rather than the soldier. And it is, if you read, say, their memoirs or letters of Pompey Elliott, who commanded the 15th Brigade, what he was proud of was that his men were, forgive me, jolly good killers. He really boasted about it, that they could stick a bayonet through the neck and kill a man very cleanly and painlessly and easily. That's what he thought the Australians should be known for, not for having been suffering victims of war. But I would argue that if we really want to do honour, and our commemorative ritual suggests we should pay honour to the men who fought the war, we should remember the war in the way they saw it. And particularly we should acknowledge that they were fighting for different values to ours. The dominant narrative of World War One for many years has been one of futility. A war that achieved nothing, that was fought by the classic depiction, lions led by donkeys, you know, by incompetent military commanders who were profligate with the men's lives. Well, of course, there's some good reasons for this, but it shouldn't be forgotten that Australia had very clear war aims in World War One. They included the maintenance of British global imperial power, the protection of the White Australia policy, the guaranteeing of Australian security in the Asia Pacific, the defence of democracy against German tyranny and aggression, and the protection of the rights of small nations such as Belgium. I think why we struggle to recapture World War One in its entirety is because some of those values are so dissonant with our own. The racism of White Australia, which of course was a core national interest, at least for Billy Hughes, now is an embarrassment to us. And it's very hard for the young to understand the ideological and emotional loyalty to the British Empire that sustained so many Australians during the war. I say to my students that I stand before them like an historical artefact because I can remember it. We used to put the shamrock on Ireland. I'm not quite sure why we did that at school, because I don't think the Irish were very keen on that. But, you know, remember putting the wattle on the maple leaf? That is, of course, another lost world. So the final thing I've tried to do in the book was to look at whether those war aims, which Australia was quite clear about, I think, at the time, were achieved. It's actually a very mixed record. As the war continued, Prime Minister Billy Hughes kept demanding, along with other Dominion leaders such as Sir Robert Borden from Canada, that the Dominions, as they were called, have a much greater say in the conduct of the war, in particular in the terms of the peace settlement. And, of course, Australia was represented as an independent nation for the first time in 1919 at the Paris Peace Conference. And Hughes behaved in a way that caused enormous merriment in the press and infuriated President Woodrow Wilson. And he did have some minor successes. For example, he, along with the other Dominion leaders, achieved the goal of keeping hold of the German colonies that the Dominions had occupied in 1914. So Australia retained the right to govern German New Guinea, albeit under a League of Nations mandate. Hughes also was very proud of the fact that he completely stymied the attempt by the Japanese, who had emerged onto the international stage during World War I, much to Australia's alarm, to get a racial equality clause included in the covenant of the League of Nations. He was very proud of that achievement. Some of his colleagues at home were rather embarrassed and mortified and said, look, perhaps this is going to have long-term negative effects on our relationship with Japan. But the one thing that Hughes did not achieve that he was really passionate about was getting the full war costs of Australia paid by the Germans. And he ended up feeling profoundly disappointed with the Treaty of Versailles. But what Hughes and many other Australians were very slow to realise, and perhaps we can understand why, was that the world order that they'd gone to war to defend had been shattered by the war. Of course, the dynastic monarchies of Germany, Russia and Austria-Hungary had collapsed, so had the Ottoman Empire, and Bolshevism had triumphed in Russia. It seemed that Germany's attempt to dominate the continent, if that's what you thought the Germans were trying to do, had been stopped, but as we know, it had not. And what had actually happened was that the price that Britain and France had paid for their victory was the erosion of their dominance. The historian Michael Howard talks about a false hegemony of Britain and France in interwar Europe. It's a very useful concept that they seemed to have won, but in fact they had been irrevocably weakened. And the only reason that wasn't apparent for a while was because the United States remained isolationist. And indeed, the World War I showed the great rise of the United States in the 20th century, the first stage of that. Similarly, Japan had become an expansionist nation, and so the threat that Australians really feared had not been contained by World War I. Now, all of that wasn't obvious in 1919 as it was in 1942 when Singapore fell, but it was obvious enough. Hughes knew that had been a peace that had been a success for the United States. He said it's a good peace for the United States and a bad peace for us. So the legacy in diplomacy was also one of loss. And so it's really quite intriguing to me that it is this war which has spawned what we now would call, I think quite appropriately, the foundational narrative of Australian nationalism, the Anzac legend. It soon gained hold on the imagination of many Australians, partly because the children were educated about it. This is only December 1916. Look at all those children making a nice little Australia. And this is on the Melbourne Cricket Ground. I'm pleased to see they've included Tasmania, which often gets forgotten in the Australian map. In fact, it's almost larger than Australia. But this is one of many processes by which Anzac and the story about the heroism of the Australians and their particular qualities of resilience and resourcefulness, egalitarianism and mateship, but above all their fighting prowess, were promulgated through the Australian population. And it would seem as if the greater the losses of the war, the more we had to have a narrative of hyperbole which invested that profound trauma with meaning and significance. And certainly Australians invested more energy probably than any other nation in building war memorials. The counts vary, but it seems we've got more war memorials per head of population than any other nation from World War I. Most of them look like this, an obelisk or a doctor. A soldier, I don't know why I said a doctor. A soldier, they were the most popular forms. Now, the Anzac legend is a huge topic. It somehow has continued to remain the dominant narrative of war in this country. It survived and evolved across the decades, performing, as I've said, a kind of mythic function in the sense that it's a charter about the past that justifies the institutions of the present. With effortless ease, it was the framework within which the experience of World War II was understood and described. Anzac survived, but only just, the Vietnam War and the equally divisive debate at that time about conscription and the radicalism and feminism of Australian youth in that period. Many of us thought that the Anzac legend was in a state of terminal decay after the Vietnam War, but to everyone's surprise, it has returned. It's now focused on the core values of endurance, courage, sacrifice and mateship, and is much more sensitive to gender and ethnicity. And it seems to be invoked by politicians, sportsmen, policemen, and many who seem to champion the importance of the individual being willing to subordinate his or her interests to those of the collective. And it's championed as what it quotes means to be Australian. Now, what that phrase means and how and why Anzac came to represent that, and why a narrative that seems to have invested the experience of war with such meaning a century ago continues play such a role in our political culture is yet, I suggest, to be explained. But that's the subject of another book and another talk. Thank you.
So, many thanks to Professor Joan Beaumont. We'll come to questions and discussion, but that's a ship departing.
Without troops.
It is, yes. They always give that noise when they head off. So, the copies, Janet Grundy's got copies of Broken Nation, Australians in the Great War, which, as I said, is a terrific book, and I'm sure Professor Beaumont will be happy to sign some after. I should say also thanks to the Gallipoli Club for providing this great facility this evening. And so we come to questions and discussion. There are many issues, of course, could be raised, but without getting too counterfactual, you make the point that there was support for the war effort during the period of 1418, say 1419. In view of that, why do you think that Prime Minister William Hughes didn't try and break a promise and bring in conscription without plebiscites? What was the factor, since he was carrying most of the country with him for the war effort, why did he feel he couldn't carry the country with him for conscription for the war effort?
Yes, well, thank you. The prevailing legislation at the time was the Defence Act of 1903, which did not allow the deployment of volunteers or indeed the regular army overseas. You could conscript men, and they had already in 1911 for home defence, but you could not conscript men for overseas military service. There has been debate about whether Hughes could have used executive powers, but most people think he could not. So you had to have a change of the legislation. And his problem was that his own Labour Party was profoundly divided on the issue. And he was told before he put the matter to the popular vote that the Labour Party would split on the issue, and indeed it did in most states and federally. So he thought, he believed he was going to win the popular vote, and so he thought, well, I'll get a popular mandate, and then that will silence my own party. It's often thought that the reason he didn't win was because in the midst of it all, he got overconfident and started to call men up. And that aggravated a lot of people. A lot of people were very aggravated by Hughes' tyrannical style of using emergency powers. I also think, having read a lot of The Australian Worker recently, that the campaign by the left was extraordinarily clever, and the editor of The Australian Worker, a man called Henry Booth, was a master of words. It was a great fear campaign. So the margin was very narrow, the margin by which the conscription was lost in 16. Hughes promised that he would not ever put the matter to the Australian public again, and that was his promise in 1917. But then it seems, and I owe this to Neville Maney, who's here tonight, that he was facing mutiny from his new nationalist colleagues, and so he went to the election to the people again in 1917, and the margin was slightly wider against in 1917.
Scott, down the back.
Thank you. Professor, you presented a very interesting historiography of the times and events around the First World War. What I'm particularly interested in, and I think you sort of studiously avoided this, is what your view is in relation to the Anzac legend and why it's persisted for 100 years. Now, I sort of came here to hear that, and I haven't heard it yet because I've enjoyed what you've said, and it took me back to sort of New South Wales Unity 35 years ago, but I'm really interested in what you think about the persistence of that legend and how it's sort of grown and dimmed and grown and in fact got a new lease of life.
Yes, well, it is an enormous topic, and some of the explanations, I'm afraid, are quite theoretical. People talk, this memory boom, as it's called, has occurred across the world. There's been this huge interest in war that's come particularly since the 1970s, when the Holocaust, in some senses, was discovered by popular media. And people have said, well, what is it now about contemporary generations that they are looking to the past to, in such a way, you know, there's a lot of family history, genealogy, and so on. And I think that the family history has played a very important role in encouraging people to be interested in the history of war, which has fed an interest in Anzac, and that family history in itself has been assisted by digital technology. The fact that you can find out where your grandfather was buried before you even go to the Western Front helps people to go on these so-called pilgrimages. So that's one element of it. But in the debate about what's going on with memory, there are many schools of thought, and some say that it's largely been orchestrated by the government or the state. That it's been, I mean, one argument even goes as far as to say that when the social welfare state collapsed in the 70s and 80s, governments needed some other way of mobilising people's allegiance, so they turned to the memory of war. These are unifying stories, Dunkirk, Gallipoli. That's what we call the top-down explanation. Personally, I think that's not sufficient. I think there has been an enormous amount of money invested in promoting the memory of war. I currently have a research system trying to find out how much the Australian government spent on commemoration since 1985, but it is mega millions. The Australian War Memorial, I dare say, has $32 million for one gallery as we speak. But obviously, I mean, if you think that it's all to do with governments promulgating a narrative about the past that serves the purposes of the present, like honouring those who are still prepared to die for the state, and there are not many of them, that suggests that the people are dupes and fools, and I don't think that's adequate. There's obviously something going on at the local level, so there's a kind of resonance between what the government is doing and what a lot of individuals in Australia have become interested in, like going back to battlefields. And I don't quite know what motivates that, nor do I know how widespread it is in Australia. Everyone talks about the resurgence, the Anzac legend, myself included. But I don't know whether that is as strong in some of the ethnic communities as it is in the Anglo-Celtic communities. Certainly the Anzac Centenary Advisory Board did two focus groups trying to find out what people thought should be done on the centenary of World War I. And not surprisingly, the Anglo-Celtic focus group said, yes, good, let's have lots of celebrations and commemorations. Those who are recent immigrants to Australia said, well, it's fine, you know, you get on with it, but we don't really connect with it at all. So I think the jury is out on how widespread the support for Anzac is. It's a very dominant narrative, and I know from my own experience that if you try to criticise it, it's quite risky politically in today's society to speak out against and say, you know, it really isn't the only story that you need to tell. Marilyn Lake, when she said this, you know, the story of Marilyn Lake, said, we need to remember that there are other narratives of the Australian past called death threats. So something very complex is going on in our society, and you might say it's to do with the fact that we have a new form of nationalism, that in a postmodern society people don't know what to believe in, it's the new religion of the Australian state. These are all the kinds of explanations that are around, but I really think we need a systematic study of what's been going on for the last 30 years before I can really answer your question.
Can I just add to that, though? If you take the Civil War in America and the 60,000 books or whatever that have been written and the new Lincoln, the film, and the idea that it's an immigrant society and this is a war that goes much further back, there's something about war and the fact that we've sacrificed blood, our own men, and I agree with you about family history because as a teacher I saw that change in schools, that individual children connected with their grandparents. Even when we went to Gallipoli, Jared and I, we connected a young man who drove us, who was a university graduate, with his great-grandfather by taking him to Gallipoli. He'd never thought about it.
He was on the Turkish side.
Yes. So, to me, I think war, and you've done a lot of history, war brings out that narrative for all people in all civilizations, migrant or otherwise, to what extent that blood sacrifice really defines a nation.
I think you're right. There is a war has a particular quality that captures people's imagination. There is a phenomenon now called Thanatourism, which is people going to sites of mass catastrophe. You can even go to a Stalinist gulag for a holiday if you wish nowadays. And I'm serious. Probably the most visited site in the world is Auschwitz. 1.3 million people a year go to Auschwitz. So there is something in the human character that I think is fascinated by mass catastrophe. And you know, I guess what fascinates us about World War I is why did so many men go? You know, why did they acquiesce in this? And why did the population tolerate it? So, yes, I think they are enduring questions, and many nationalist narratives, of course, are underpinned by the story, as you say, of a blood sacrifice. We don't make stories about knitting, we make stories about warriors.
Question here and then down there.
I saw a film that was to teach about the war in the schools, you know, about 20 years ago, and in that, General Haig is apparently going up to the Western Front, to the actual front, where the front point fighting took place, and said, my God, did we send men to fight in this? And I don't know whether that just sort of affecting, you know, we've got to be nasty to the British generals because they're incompetent, or actually, was he so? Was it possible? But he didn't know what the Western Front, what the...
question is whether General Douglas Haig knew what the Western Front was like.
Yeah, what the conditions meant for him.
Douglas Haig has been an extremely controversial and divisive figure. You know, the people who hated him and have been people who have come to his defence. I think he knew what the war was like, but he could not, nor could his own government, who frankly had the option of sacking him and chose not to, even though they were David Lloyd George were very critical of Haig, but he never actually sacked him. They couldn't think what else to do. And I've talked about that for years. They were stuck with this stalemate on the Western Front, and it seemed the only way to break it with the technology they had available at the beginning of the war was to keep hammering away at the Germans in these catastrophic battles. Why Haig has been criticised so much is because in both the Somme and Ypres, the third Ypres or Passchendaele, he kept going too long. As I say in the book, if Haig had stopped the third Ypres in early October, it would have been considered a very successful battle. It was the fact he kept going into the rain in November that caused such controversy. I have to say, come to have a sort of grudging what? Not admiration, but recognition that had you not had a man like Haig, they would have negotiated a peace, I think. I mean, you had to have people who were willing to go on making these terrible decisions.
Like Churchill.
Like Churchill in World War II, yes. And so you may think, I mean, obviously there should have been a negotiated peace much earlier. They should have negotiated a peace at the end of 1916 after the Battle of the Somme. But given that Germany would not retreat from France, and Germany behaved appallingly when it did have the opportunity to occupy parts of Russia, and it was a very brutal occupying power in Belgium, and would not offer to withdraw from Belgium, the British kept thinking, well, they had to keep going. And the French were collapsing, so Haig knew that the only people who were going to win the war were the British Army, with ultimately the help of the United States. We mustn't forget the United States, they were very important in 1918.
Now we've got a question here. You've got to be quick now.
Yes, do you think that the fervour now of the Gallipoli and the movement and so forth is partly because the things that were in place for the First World War and the Second World War, such as the challenge, patriotism, the sense of adventure, and possibly other things, are not in place now? So that three of the things that took men off to both of those conflicts are not there now, and they see it in a way nostalgically as something we don't have now.
That may be part of it. I think there are elements of nostalgia and sentimentality which most scholars would attribute to the fact that we are now so far away from the war that we're not exposed to its brutality. We can have a sort of sanitised memory of the war. And, you know, you'd have to, I think, argue that there is nobody alive who is experiencing genuine grief as a result of World War I. People get very emotional when they go to cemeteries. I'm not really quite sure what's going on there. I think it's the sense of the mortality of the young. I mean, I took my daughter to Gallipoli and I had not primed her at all to have any particular response, and within 5 minutes she's feeling terribly moved by the age of the young men. I would attribute a huge amount to the practice, quite accidental practice, of the British Empire of giving everybody a tombstone. If we had mass graves, such as the Germans have, there's one German mass grave, 45,000 bodies, you don't connect for the mass grave. You connect when you see your family name and he's 17 and there's a message that says he was only one in a million, but he was the only one to us. And it's those headstones, I think, which perpetuate the emotional response. And we've all seen them, you know, the crosses, the headstones lined up in like a car park. I mean, it's emotional effect is very strong.
Right down the back.
Simple question. Is it good that he won?
Ah.
The other way of looking at it would have been better had we lost.
This is a bit of another comment, really. I think one of the things that we don't acknowledge is how much our national discussion about war is shaped by the fact that we did win the two world wars. There's a sort of muted triumphalism in a lot of our discussion of the two world wars. I guess, you know, if you're into counterfactual history, as obviously I am, it would have been better if there had been a negotiated peace which did not put the Allies in the position to impose the punitive peace that they did on Germany. Many people would now argue that the two world wars were the one war and that nothing was really resolved by the Treaty of Versailles. And, of course, in the case of the Balkans, we still continue to live with the consequences of the disintegration of the Austro-Hungarian Empire and the Ottoman Empire. The imperial solution imposed on the Ottoman Empire is still we're living with the legacy of those boundaries. So, yes, I think it would have been better if there'd been a negotiated peace, but as I said, it didn't really seem to be possible at the time.
There we go with Philip. We've got to be brief now, and then down the back. Yeah.
Just coming back to the headstones, is it true that the reason they're there is because of Rudyard Kipling lost his son? And he said that every soldier had to be identified because he went back and looked for his son?
Rudyard Kipling was very important in the commemorative processes, but the main initiative behind what was then called the Imperial War Graves Commission was a man called Fabian Ware, who really went to battlefields and came back convinced that in the interests of democracy and egalitarianism, you couldn't have families that could afford to bring a body home doing so, and the poor having their sons and husbands left where they had died. So it was a big debate in Britain, and of course the Americans have always brought the boys home. But Fabian Weir ultimately won the day, and it was decided to bury men as far as possible where they died. They were, of course, all exhumed and reburied in the order that we're familiar with. Kipling's contribution, and as you know, Kipling was just devastated by the death of his son, and I commend to you a film called My Boy Jack if you haven't seen it. And he was particularly devastated because his son was missing. There was supposed to be a body in 1992, I think it was, that was Kipling's son, but they're still not convinced it was. And the torment of your son being missing was obviously profound, and perhaps a third of the men on the Western Front were missing. So Kipling came up with "Known unto God" as the inscription on the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. I think he made the choice of "Their name liveth forevermore," and he was very influential in the commemorative movement.
Fred, we're going to be brief. Yep.
Thank you very much. Two quick things.
We're going to be quick.
You mentioned the attitude of the volunteers to the conscripts, or the potential conscripts, and the first time hit me why my father's generation, who was second AIF, why they felt so negatively about the Chocos. It was so derogatory about the Chocos in World War II, so that did that. The second point was, do you think that the fact that we realised for the first time in World War I how incompetent the British leaders were, and it was only when the Australian leaders like Monash actually achieved things, that was part of the Anzac spirit, and so for the first time we started to be a bit more independent. Thank you.
Well, I think that's one of the bits of myth that does need to be hit on the head. I mean, Monash was a good commander, but there were plenty of other good commanders by that stage. Chris Pugsley, the New Zealand historian, has mounted a very strong case that most of the tactical innovation was initiated by the Canadian Corps under Curry. Curry was a very good commander. General Plumer was recognised. I mean, he looks like General Blimp, but he's actually was a very good commander. And a lot of the things for which Monash is famed, like having conferences beforehand and telling everybody about their delegated role, had been pioneered by Plumer, and he'd actually learnt them from Plumer. So... yes, there were a lot of reservations amongst some of the Australian commanders, particularly Pompey Ellett, about the British command, but it's something which has, I think, grown over the century rather than being something that really existed in World War I to a very damaging degree, at least.
Scott, we can take it.
Yep. Just a quick supplementary. Let me bring you back to the 80s and 90s and the paradox that exists with the increasing nostalgia of the First World War and the decline in interest in war veterans who may have come from Vietnam and other conflicts, either before Vietnam or since Vietnam. Why?
Well, I would disagree with you. I don't think we have a decline of attention to the veterans. I mean, one of the arguments that I've developed in several pieces I've written about the Anzac legend, and others have made the same point, is that what seems to have happened is as the proportion of the Australian population that are in the Australian Defence Force has shrunk to a point where, you know, we have very few men and women who are in the Defence Force, and we deploy very few of them overseas, the reverence with which they're treated has grown exponentially. I mean, I ask everybody in my classes, and I'll ask you, what is it that made Julia Gillard come home when five men died in Afghanistan? She came home from an international conference. Now, no politician in World War One would have come home when five men died. Five? I mean, for goodness sakes, 20,000 died on the first day of the Somme. So we have prime ministers go to every funeral now for defence personnel. And I would argue that this is partly because, if I can use some, some sociological political theory, that we still need men and women who are willing to die in the interests of the community, be they bushfire fighters or police or soldiers. And therefore, because we live in such a materialistic and individualistic society, we give even greater honour to the men and women who serve. And we know from World War One that the RSL were able to position the diggers as superior citizens because they'd volunteered. So we put names of volunteers on most of these memorials. We're one of the few countries that does it. Got lots of them. About half of the memorials list everybody who went, not just the men who died, because going was so important. So in the Australian tradition, the soldier has been the citizen in arms, and the citizens who choose to fight become the superior citizens, and I think that's very pronounced today.
Okay, now we've got to stop. We're right on time, so that's it. Would you just step aside for a second? Look, many thanks to Professor Beaumont. We're right on time. We always finish on time. I'm sure Professor Beaumont would be happy to sign copies of Broken Nation. I bought the book in Melbourne. I read a large part of it on the plane coming back. My uncle died in Passchendaele, but I was always conscious of the huge impact of the First War on my mother's family. And here in Broken Nation, for the first time I actually read a book that was looking at the battles, complicated as they were on the Western Front and in Gallipoli, but also about the home front. And I think, and in a way that people could understand without knowing all the technical details that you need to know to follow military campaigns. So I think you've done a great job. And also it's very impressed you have a degree of admiration for General Douglas Haig, because after all, we won the war, which is better than losing it, I'd have to say. So look, I think you've done a great work. I know you'll be busy over the next few years as the commemorations roll around, but I think Broken Nation's a terrific work, and I congratulate you, and no doubt we'll have you back again in the future. Well done. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.